Welcome to KDNK's Weekly Newsreel,
a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. The weekly newsreel is underwritten by RJ Paddywax Pet Outfitters, next to City Market in Elgibel. Open 7 days a week. More info at 970-963-1700 or rjpaddywax.com.
I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. All of us at KDNK hope you're having a pleasant Independence Day. Fire restrictions are in place.
Stage 1 fire restrictions are in effect for all of unincorporated Garfield County, the White River National Forest, Bureau of Land Management land in Eagle, Garfield, and Picken counties, and unincorporated private lands in Eagle and Picken counties. A fireworks ban is in place for Garfield County, and fireworks are prohibited at all times on federal lands.
This week's headlines include COVID closings, a protest death, and the arrest of a Carbondale resident.
Carbondale caterer Peter O'Grady was arrested Tuesday and charged with felony aggravated sexual exploitation of children. The Post-Independent reports that O'Grady, owner of Creative Catering, was charged after Eagle County Sheriff's deputies searched his home and seized computers, mass storage devices, and cell phones that yielded, quote, large amounts of suspected online child pornography, end quote. O'Grady bonded out of jail and is scheduled to be in court July 29th.
So much for the movies at Movieland 7 in Elgibel. The Aspen Daily News reports that the theater closed last night after final showings of Dunkirk and Anchorman. The theater reopened mid-June, offering $5 classic films and reserved seating, contact-free purchases, and social distancing. It is unknown exactly why the theater has gone dark.
Big B's Delicious Orchards in Hotchkiss is closed. A post on the business Facebook page announced that a friend of an employee tested positive for COVID-19, so the store, cafe, and campgrounds are closed until further notice.
On June 4th, a protest in Alamosa turned violent, reports the Colorado Independent. About a dozen protesters were apparently peacefully demonstrating the killing of George Floyd by police and demanding police accountability and racial justice. At an intersection on Main Street, the group occupied the crosswalk during the red light and let cars pass when the light turned green. Just before 6 p.m., a man driving a Dodge Ram pickup pulled up to the red light, then accelerated into the crosswalk. A video of the scene then shows a white male protester pull out a gun from his waistband and shoot the driver in the head. James Edward Marshall IV, the 27-year-old gunman, faces several charges, including attempted murder.
William Perry Pendley could become the next director of the Bureau of Land Management. President Trump last week announced plans to nominate Pendley for the job, but reports E&E News, Pendley's views on racial inequality and social justice could become obstacles to his confirmation. Pendley wrote a November 2017 op-ed in the Washington Examiner dismissing the Black Lives Matter movement. He wrote that the movement was based on a lie and endangered police and other citizens. Pendley has served as acting Bureau of Land Management director for almost 1 year.
Democratic U.S. Senator Michael Bennett, in a press release Friday, decried the nomination of William Perry Pendley as the head of the Bureau of Land Management. Bennett said Pendley's policies do not reflect Colorado's values and commitment to conservation.
Colorado Governor Jared Polis reordered bars and nightclubs to close, citing a recent uptick in coronavirus cases over the past 2 weeks. The closure will be in effect for 30 days, beginning July 1st. The governor said rising disease levels in other states have been linked to bars.
At this point, having bars and nightlife in an unsustainable way is simply too big a risk of a setback for Colorado.
Bars in Colorado were first reopened less than 2 weeks ago with limited capacity. Under the new closure, patrons will still be able to order alcohol for pickup, thanks to a recent and bipartisan piece of legislation that was signed into law before the end of the session.
The Colorado Supreme Court on Wednesday unanimously rejected Governor Polis' effort to allow signatures for ballot initiatives to be gathered by email and mail, reports the Colorado Sun. The court says Polis does not have the power to suspend a requirement in the state's constitution, even in a disaster emergency like the COVID-19 crisis. The state constitution requires that ballot initiatives be signed in the presence of the petition circulator and cannot be suspended by executive order. The decision marks the first court-ordered reversal of an action taken by Polis in response to the coronavirus.
The Colorado Supreme Court Monday unanimously upheld the state's ban on large-capacity gun magazines, reports the Denver Post. The court ruled that the ban is a, quote, reasonable exercise of police power that has neither the purpose nor effect of nullifying the right to bear arms in self-defense set out in the Colorado Constitution, end quote. The ban on magazines that hold more than 15 rounds was put in place in 2013 in the wake of the 2012 Aurora theater shooting, when a gunman used a magazine to fire more than 60 rounds in less than a minute, killing 12 and wounding dozens. Out of 3,506,754 active voters in Colorado, close to 41% chose who will run in November's election. Unofficial results as of 11:57 p.m. Tuesday show that in the Democratic contest to see who will challenge Republican incumbent Cory Gardner for U.S. Senator this November, former Governor John Hickenlooper took close to 60% of the votes, leaving Andrew Romanoff with a little more than 40%. Democrat Diane Mitch Bush will run against Rifle resident Lauren Boebert, a Republican, for U.S. Representative of the 3rd Congressional District. Boebert toppled incumbent Scott Tipton with 54.62% of the votes statewide. Tipton took Garfield County, but only by 20 votes. Carbondale residents Carl Hanlon, a Democrat, and Republican incumbent Bob Rankin will face off for the state Senate seat for District 8. Hanlon garnered close to 57% of the votes in the 7-county district over challenger Arne Menconi. Republican incumbent state representative for the 57th district, Perry Will, takes on Democratic challenger Colin Wilhelm. Both ran unopposed in the primary. Also running unopposed in the Garfield County commissioner races, Democrat Katrina Byers will challenge incumbent Republican John Martin. And Democrat Leslie Robinson faces incumbent Mike Sampson in November. 41% of 33,002 voters cast ballots in Garfield County. For this week's edition of the Weekly Newsreel, let's start off with the protest section. Local demonstrations in support of Black Lives Matter continued last weekend. Among Carbondale's participants, Megan Shapiro detailed the implications of defunding police.
I really would be devastated to see this rise in energy and attention and fury not go anywhere and just start to dissipate.
What do you think would be an acceptable resolution?
I think here's one of 500 things I could say right now, but one of them is helping people understand what it means when people talk about defunding police. Because I think people have a really strong initial reaction to that because it incites fear of like, wait, these are the people that keep my community safe, even if some of them are quote unquote not so good or bad eggs, right? Which is a narrative. But anyway, the difference between defunding and abolishing and what it looks like really getting examples of what it would look like to reallocate those resources. All these people that could receive training and funding to be responding to situations that are charged, that you could dial 911 and the operator would direct you in a really appropriate direction of who could support you right now or whatever's happening. Like the idea that you could call for suspected domestic violence and a group of social workers would show up, it gives me chills to think that that would be our crisis response.
KDNK's Raleigh Burley also spoke with other demonstrators about their solidarity.
Thank you for being here and taking a knee in honor and in solidarity with the families and the victims of police brutality. Elijah McClain, Rayshard Brooks,
Drea Marsh maintains the weekly tradition of a silent vigil at Carbondale's 4th Street Plaza in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. With dwindling numbers, this demonstration has reoccurred every Saturday since May 30th, first organized by April Spalding.
Derek Garner, Trayvon Martin, and every other human being who has been brutalized and murdered by our racist system and the tyranny of those who seek to control and oppress throughout all of our history.
This latest gathering followed the Juneteenth march that was met with a counter-protest organized by Back Our Blue. Speaker Brian Alvarez reflected on the experience as alarming.
Racism exists in this valley. It exists in different ways and in different forms. In Rifle, with the Black Lives Matter protests, there are people there, people of color and their allies that were marching for the Black Lives Matter movement. At the same time, there is a counter-protest where they're intimidating and having assault weapons and armor in response to the Black Lives Matter protest. If the roles had been switched and the people of color were the ones that came to the rally with these weapons, with this intimidating approach to the protest, the story would have been much different.
When the crowd was invited to share other impressions from the incident, a young woman named Willow stepped forward.
We were also told that there were going to be like barricades between the two sides of the protest and that the Black Lives Matter protesters were going to be protected no matter what. We had nothing to worry about. So I was a little disturbed when there were men with guns on our side of the street that were obviously trying to intimidate people and the cops were just kind of standing there and not concerned about it. There have been black boys who have been killed for having toy guns. There are black men who have been killed for having cell phones in their pockets that the cops kind of maybe sort of thought could be a gun potentially. So the fact that there were white men in full like paramilitary gear, like literally just a few feet away from me, and the cops didn't have a problem with that, it really says a lot.
Brian encouraged participants to maintain the momentum in favor of equal rights for all.
I stand here before all of you as a gay Latino, fighting for the rights for the black community to live. And the reason why is because I can't expect anyone to help me and my community to fight our systems of oppression if I'm not willing to do the same for others.
In Glenwood Springs on Sunday, another group gathered for a march that was titled All Black Lives Matter by organizer Travis Wilson.
I went to a protest in early June in Rifle and also one in Glenwood. And then Breonna Taylor's murder was just everywhere, and it just spoke to me. It was like, I really want to speak up for her. I want to speak up for all the lives that matter in the black community. And then other issues that came up, like the murder of Dominique Vels, Elijah McClain. More and more of these showed up, and it's like, yes, yes. And that's also Pride Month, so this is definitely the time to speak.
For Travis as well, Black Lives Matter intersects with fighting prejudice more generally.
I'm a gay man, and, you know, I have never faced prejudice for my skin color, but I have faced prejudice, absolutely.
Recognizing that change will happen incrementally over a long period of time, Travis's message to participants on Sunday was to vote.
Protests are so good. Speaking out is so good, but there's more to it than that. You don't want to just be that person who's screaming till they're blue in the face and your throat has become a desert. You need to take action. And what I mean by that is you need to vote. Voting is key.
Back in Carbondale, Speaker Karen Zavala spoke to the power of affecting broad change from within our small communities.
Carbondale itself is big enough to make such a huge improvement. You start small here, make your way bigger, make your way to Aspen, Glenwood, eventually to Rifle. We see how Denver's doing things, and this isn't just one big movement. It started off as such small movements that happen.
We keep doing what needs to be done until we see the change we want to see. And this is just the truth. This is not a sitcom where we galvanize for 20 minutes and go, you know what? Yeah, this isn't right. And then we fix it and we all have a happy ending. That's not how life is. This kind of work takes a while. It could be months. It could be years. But giving up isn't the answer. And just thinking that it's going to be quick isn't the answer.
For Kitty and K News, I'm Raleigh Burley.
You're listening to the weekly news reel featuring top stories aired between Monday and Friday. In-kind support comes from Grassroots Community Network, promoting civic participation through civil discourse, creative endeavors, and cultural interaction. More info at grassrootstv.org.
Hey, Gavin Dahl. Just want to thank you for all of your hard work and your years of service at KDNK. And good luck with KVNF in Montrose. COVID-19 is making a comeback in the nation and in Garfield County. Here's how local officials are handling a rocky reopening.
The landscape of Carbondale's 300 block on Main Street has shifted repeatedly throughout the last month. The block's business owners and the town's board of trustees are struggling to agree on changes in traffic patterns that will most benefit businesses and patrons during COVID-19's restrictions.
And having been through 3 months with the task force, where so many people were devoting so much time to trying to make it work, to have things fall apart right now in terms of this block is so disheartening.
That's Carbondale Mayor Dan Richardson speaking at the June 23rd Board of Trustees meeting. In a previous meeting, the block's roadway had already been reduced to one-way traffic in a single lane so that businesses could spill onto the roadway. This traffic lane flipped to pedestrian use Friday and Saturday evenings. This design was put to the test for a couple weeks, but it soon became apparent that food and beverage businesses and retail businesses have very different needs. And these differences were leading to conflicts.
So I would ask everyone to please put away the judgment, put away the derogatory comments, and I appreciate that everyone is on this call, that they are trying to work together, but try harder because we can do better than this.
Further discussion of changes would have been on hold until the board's next regular meeting, July 14th, but trustee Erica Sparhawk met with business owners on Friday the 26th in order to get a special board meeting scheduled sooner.
The group decided that it would work to open it back up to two-way traffic during the day, every day of the week. Main Street will then close at 4 p.m. on either end of that block. During the day, for the two-way traffic to work, the restaurants that already have the existing decks will need to pull their tables, you know, back maybe onto the deck or just out of the way.
The agreement also includes two additional parking spaces for Batch so that their outdoor patio will maintain its current square footage, though its shape will change. Short-term parking spaces have mostly returned to regular parking status. Sunday traffic patterns remain in question as businesses decide whether to open at all on Sundays. The new plan allocates funds for extra marketing for Carbondale businesses. Trustee Ben Baumfalk says these expenses will likely be reimbursed through Garfield County's funds from the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security, or CARES Act.
I just think that's good to know as we consider, you know, everything that we're doing right now. We know we're in a tight budget situation, but anything that's directly COVID-related, it seems like it's a good opportunity to leverage that funding.
Changes in the agreement were put into place Wednesday this week. Amy Charters of Lulubelle Clothing Boutique says she's hoping 300 block Main Street will be leaving the hostilities behind.
I really hope this puts us on the path to helping our block heal, because I feel like it has been a real sad time. And I just hope that we can all move forward together and kind of repair some of those relationships that are going on our block.
For KDNK News, I'm Kathleen Shannon.
Up until this week, Garfield County had lost two residents to COVID-19, compared to Eagle County's 8 and 382 in Denver County. But that changed on Thursday, when the third person, a 70-year-old man, succumbed to the virus. His wife is in quarantine. Confirmed cases are at an all-time high in the county, 307 as of Thursday evening, reports Garfield County Public Health. The spike began in June, jumping from 11 cases the last week of May to 14 in the first week of June. And according to a graph of new onset cases at the Garfield County website, the virus has been increasing. 152 new onset cases were reported by the end of June. The state granted Garfield County a variance on May 23rd, which allowed certain businesses to open up with restrictions. But the variance came with a caveat. Should the county's infection rate jump to 60 new cases in a two-week period, the variants would go away. That didn't happen, but it got pretty close.
So we saw a surge of cases in the middle of June, which is about 3 weeks after our variant was passed.
Mason Hostat is with the county's public health department.
We can see that there might be a loosening of restrictions, maybe have made people feel like the virus was over.
The county did not lose the variants, but the spike prohibits a move into a less restrictive reopening phase. Hostat told KDNK that the state has a new set of criteria that determine if any county can move into a less restrictive phase. Counties fall into a green, yellow, or red category, depending on virus spread.
And so the low is 25 or fewer cases per 100,000 people. The medium, yellow, is 50 cases or fewer per 100,000 people. And then the last, the high, is 50 to 100 cases per 100,000 people.
Garfield County doesn't have 100,000 residents, so we adjusted the data to fit the county's population.
And as you can see, as of right now, we're high. We're in a red.
We have to be able to pull these numbers down if we're ever going to move into future stages.
Carrie Godis is the public information officer for County Public Health. In order to move to the next reopening phase, the county needs to prove to the state that the viral spread is as low as 15 cases in a two-week period, a number not seen in Garfield County since late May. Godis says county residents need to wear face coverings, wash hands, socially distance, and quarantine if symptoms appear. She adds that spikes in cases of the virus seem to occur around holidays.
So we just know that even though we're given these permissions to be more open, we have to do that with a great deal of personal responsibility.
Carbondale Mayor Dan Richardson agrees.
If we don't do something about it right now, then I'm really concerned about the long-term impact.
He says it's more than just masking up, especially over the holiday weekend.
With the rising cases, it's take the social distancing seriously, and not everybody has. I think everybody knows the protocol really well. We need to implement them.
He adds that businesses like restaurants, hotels, and some retailers are on the edge financially.
If we had to backtrack, I'm really concerned about that. I think if we have to remain at 50% capacity when the weather gets cold and you can't eat outside, I think we would see businesses that couldn't survive that.
Carrie Godis says public health departments can only go so far in keeping the virus at bay.
If we can't have more people taking action, personal action, to help us, then it's going to be almost impossible to get a handle on the spread.
Pat Morrissey joined Mountain Voices Project as a volunteer with English in Action, one of the 29 organizations that comprise this coalition of local nonprofits, education institutions, and religious congregations.
The Landlord-Tenant Housing Recovery Plan is aimed at helping to keep tenants who are having financial hardship in place and at the same time to keep their landlords afloat so that they can pay their bills.
The Landlord-Tenant Recovery Plan grew from an immediate need.
The pandemic hits, the financial fallout is tangible, visible, and coming fast. And Mountain Voices Project just shifted gears and said, what do we need to be doing right this moment?
With the goal of raising $1 million through a combination of public and private donations, the fund would work as follows.
The way in which the program works is it provides assistance to the landlord and the tenant, but first the two of them have to come to agreement. The tenant agrees that they'll pay one-third of the rent. Now, maybe they can't pay it this month, or maybe not next month, and they might need a payment plan once they get back to work, but they agree to pay one-third of the rent. The landlord, recognizing that he wants to keep this tenant, and there's no real way to get money out of him if the tenant doesn't have it, agrees to forgive a third of the rent. And then the fund, the Housing Recovery Fund, pays the landlord the other one-third.
The idea for splitting costs into thirds came from discussions among Mountain Voices Project members as a way of spreading aid, specifically CARES Act assistance, to reach as many people as possible by also sharing the challenges wrought by this pandemic and the subsequent economic hardship.
Somebody said to us, actually it was a banker, said to me, you know what, we just got to distribute the pain.
With over one-tenth raised towards its goal of $1 million, Mountain Voices Project is currently in dialogue with Pickin Eagle and Garfield counties.
Trying to see that people don't fall through the cracks, tenants don't lose their homes, landlords can still stay afloat. We thought that that's a shared responsibility of the entire community. So for us, that means that government has a role to play. But also let's look to private foundations or corporate donations or individual donations. And let's put that money together in a pot.
Having formally presented a proposal to Garfield County on June 15th, asking for $500,000, the group was directed to first speak with other nonprofits already offering housing assistance and to obtain commitments from the other two counties. For KDNK News, I'm Raleigh Burley.
Parachute Police Sergeant Justin Mayfield and his family caught COVID-19 in March.
Everybody had a really bad cough, that dry, hacky cough. Cough so much that every muscle in your chest or torso hurt.
He told his story late last month during a City of Glenwood Springs Facebook Live public forum.
How I contracted it was I went to an FBI lead at a training up in Eagle back in March. This was a week-long training where I was up there along with about 30 other law enforcement members.
He says COVID cut the training short and he came home.
I returned to work for 3 days, but on the fourth day, I was not feeling as well as I should have been, or I guess beginning to not feel well. My wife and son, they were starting to get sick, and they were both coughing really badly.
His family sought help at Grand River Health, but were never tested. He said they were considered presumptive positive for COVID, but Mayfield was tested for the virus. At first, he said because there weren't enough tests, the staff wanted to use a viral panel, but his doctor said no.
I'm a first responder. I was up in Eagle, where the outbreak was beginning, and also I'm a type 1 diabetic, so he overrode that and sent it off as a test for COVID.
The Parachute Police Department said that no other officers contracted the disease, but Mayfield and his family quarantined at home. He added that he and his son ran a low-grade fever for 2 or 3 days.
But my wife, she ran a fever of about 100 degrees to 101 for 13 days straight. And that was while taking medications like ibuprofen and Tylenol, trying to help reduce and keep it down.
His wife was diagnosed with COVID lung, which could indicate tissue damage. Mayfield says the family has recovered, but he still feels the effects of the virus.
I find myself getting winded a lot more easily than I used to. I would love to go and go see if I can get a chest x-ray to see what do my lungs look like. That's where I'm curious if there's still that scarring of the lung tissue that may still be there and it's just going to take time to heal. Will it heal? That I don't know.
He said COVID-19 is not the flu and encouraged the public to wear masks and take precautions.
It was a month of isolation at home and it was not pleasant. Coughing just so hard that your whole body aches, and the flu was the common cold in comparison.
That does it for this week's newsreel on KDNK. All of our stories and more are at kdnk.org. The Weekly Newsreel is a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening and have a great week.